trace myself through this database, I could actually call this my yellow line in here and your blue line in here are padding through the data, much like in a game structure, a digital game structure. At the end of my experience, I can capture that as a narrative, as a story. And this inverts the usual Saussurean distinction, where usually the narrative is the scarce information, and it's taken from a lot of other possibilities. Here we have a lot of other possibilities to begin with, and what we do, what I do and what you do, are going to be different, but we'll specify the narrative line. Now, again, this is a daunting reality. It's very, when people face this, they tend to not be engaged by it. So what tricks can we learn? How do algorithms fit into this story? And to me, they fit in by learning from what YouTube has the same problem. Huge amounts of data uploaded all the time. If it were just you and the data, it would be pointless. But there's a little algorithm that tries to figure out your interest, and it makes a few suggestions on the side. It takes a near infinite amount of material and reduces it to a few choices. And each choice you make further refines the algorithm so that the next 5 selections you get are perhaps even closer to what you want. We know this, here's a bad example, but when it works quite well. Amazon's recommendation system. If you leave your cookies on, it refines ever better your sense of, again, this is a funny example because it doesn't work. If you look at the advertisements that Google provides on the side of your page, it's tracking your search and refining ever better who you are. It's insidious, it's creepy, but on the other hand, it's a very handy tool if we want to think about shaping a kind of pas de deux between the user and an algorithm that makes order out of chaos. Now, if we think about the role of the algorithm in our culture, and this is a big claim I want to make, but it's an important claim, we can see increasing evidence of algorithms just about everywhere in our cultural lives. Here's an example, and it's an increasingly frequent example, from the Wall Street Journal, of an algorithm-written story. So if you look at the signature line for this headline, Forbes Earnings Preview, it's written by narrative science. Who is narrative science? Narrative science is an algorithm. It's a story written by an algorithm, and it's also a story read by algorithms because the keywords have to be pulled out for indexing. So it's a very interesting recursive moment in our cultural production. Culture produced by algorithms for algorithms. It's also produced for us, of course. We see algorithms being used now by lawyers to sort of predict how a lawsuit will go, to predict how a case will evolve, what the chances are in the courtroom. Grading of national essays in the United States, secondary school essays where children have to write. These are, they're finding that algorithms are doing actually a more consistent job than the human readers, the underpaid, you know, slaves that they hire to do this stuff. Our financial systems are algorithm driven. To make a very big claim, almost as big as this mobile phone as the neural network of our culture, as I see it, our culture is at a very interesting turning point. From the introduction of things like three-point perspective, the Weltbild, the world picture that Heidegger talks about, it coincides with the notion of authorship as an attribution. The cult of authorship is born more or less in the same period as three-point perspective. These are notions that define the self vis-a-vis the world. Much of what Heidegger was interested in this essay is the object-subject relation. The thing that Descartes worked so hard to define when he was working in Utrecht, I should say. He did much of his work in Utrecht, lived there for ages, until the university burned his books. In any case, the defining character of the modern seems to me to be very much about, to be embedded in three-point perspective, embedded in this way of seeing. I mean, this is the basis of our geometry, the basis of our, it comes from the Greeks, of course, but so does the algorithm. Cultivated in our way of seeing, cultivated in our notions of authorship, articulated by Descartes and Heidegger. And we're at a moment where something different is happening. If you look at Photosynth, an application like Photosynth, where 600, 1,000 photos can be combined into, because of an algorithmic search for points of uniqueness, into a kind of static but mobile space that you can navigate. Whose point of view is this? We read it as if it's a point of view because that's our tradition, but It's many points of view, many optical systems, many cameras. So this contrast between the last few hundred years that are built upon stable, calculable, three-point perspective, and something that looks similar, but in fact is fundamentally different, many points of view embedded, is this shift that I think we're undergoing. We can see it in the world of the word. Diderot's encyclopedia is, you know if there's a mistake there, you know who to blame. Wikipedia, you can find the line you put, you can look behind the page and see what's your line or someone else's or who took it away. But at the end of the day, it reads as a coherent text that we apply but it's not. It's something quite different. Collaborative, we can still find our individuality, but not the single authored texts that we've inherited for the last few hundred years. Our navigation systems. Mercator's cylindrical projection map, stability, predictability, versus the kind of ad hoc, situational, algorithmically based navigation systems we're using. And there are hundreds of these algorithmic systems out there. So to me, this is about the algorithm is, there are lots of things to talk about here, but just for now, in my last minutes, I want to talk about their potential to facilitate collaborative work, especially things that are complex, that have lots of data. There's a collaboration possible through creative use of algorithms that makes the database into something suddenly usable, that enables us to step away from the single author and to facilitate collaborative authorship. So I think with that, I will stop.
Okay. Thank you very much, Williams. Thank you very much. I think we have a little time for questions, and probably you have. Just one for you, William. It's not in the center of your demonstration, but in the beginning you spoke about discretion, speaking about mobile telephone. But some researchers are working, especially of the individual data and all the question of the private life. What do you think about it? About discretion, in a way, yes, but in the other hand, probably it's a really question.
So this is a place to look for a very interesting corollary. Is so when the cameras goes back to the 1830s, but in the 1880s. Especially in the 1890s, Kodak and others start to introduce miniature cameras, spy cameras, buttonhole cameras, anywhere it is a buttonhole. And there's a panic in the public, in America anyway, they're called Kodakers, so Kodak, but they're called Kodakers. And the Kodakers are seen as a public menace. They're people that take photos that violate the public-private divide. There's a great social anxiety. I mean, a lot of articles written about this anxiety of redefining the public-private. So this is a very clear historical precedent of course, there are legal cases. Oscar Wilde, for example, a big legal case. Who owns the photo? Is it the taker of the photo? Or is it the subject of the photo? Because Oscar Wilde argues the photo has no significance without my picture. I own this, not the man who took it. So there's a lot of redefinitions of the borders, and I think we're at one of those moments where these tensions are playing out. Mm-hmm. But an example from the Van Gogh Museum, no photography allowed. Mm. Okay, no photography allowed, of course. It's a museum, they want you to buy the pictures. But they have QR code on the wall. So you need your phone to take a picture of the QR code in order to hear the music of Sibelius when you're looking at the painting. So. And of course, while you're at it, you can snap the picture too. So I think we're at this moment of a kind of transitional logic, and it's about redefining our notions of public-private. And we're seeing that across the board. The media producers at the industry at large is trying to hold its products as if it's still the industrial era of selling things, and we're in a moment when it's all digital and flowing around. So it's an awkward